to 2 Samuel 3, 2 Samuel chapter 3. You know, many times we're tempted to want to do things in a way that advantages us. In other words, to take shortcuts, to cut corners, and not to trust God in the midst of things. To say, you know, God, I know your principles say to do this, but I feel like it would be really helpful if I did it my own way. I mean, really, that is the pressure that David had felt in his life for much of his life. Here he had been the anointed king of Israel, and he had to wait for God to make that happen and not try to make it happen himself. All right? And this is temptations that we get into in life, that, Lord, you know, if I cut corners at work or if I cheat a few people out of things, then my numbers will be better and I'll get a promotion. Instead of saying, well, if the Lord wants you to get a promotion, and maybe he does, that maybe you do that by trusting the Lord, praying about it and trusting the Lord. Or maybe we have young people in here say, you know, I'd really like to get married, and there's this really good-looking young man at work, or this is a really beautiful young woman at work. And yeah, they're not a Christian, but, you know, I don't want to grow up to be, you know, single until I'm 75. And so, you know, God would understand certainly if I marry an unbeliever. Well, I have to say that the vast majority of the time that ends up to the detriment of the soul of the person who does it. Now, sometimes, and this does happen, that sometimes, you know, on a rare occasion that somebody comes to faith in Christ, but many times that ends up to the detriment of the soul of the person who does it. And so there's times that we want to make things happen our own way. We want to force God's hand, if you would, or help God along. And that's been the pressure on David throughout the good portion of 1 Samuel and here into 2 Samuel. And here we see God's beginning to give the kingdom to David. Verse 1. Now there was a long war between the house of Saul and the house of David. But David waxed stronger and stronger, and the house of Saul waxed weaker and weaker. All right? Now we find out here that this war between David and Saul's house, between the competing factions here, between Ishbosheth, the descendant of Saul, and David, who's king in Hebron, the struggle between them goes on for a long time. We know, as we put pieces of scripture together, that this is about a 7-year conflict, something like that. And so this is a long war. But David grows stronger and stronger in this time. David's the one who's seeing God's blessing, and Saul's side grows weaker and weaker. And unto David were sons born in Hebron. And his firstborn was Amnon of Ahinoam, the Jezreelitess. And his second, Kileab of Abigail, the wife of Nabal, the Carmelite. And the third, Absalom, the son of Maacah, the daughter of Talmai, king of Geshur. And the fourth, Adonijah, the son of Haggith. And the fifth, Shephatiah, the son of Abital. And the sixth, Ithream by Eglah, David's wife. These were born to David in Hebron. So we get this list of these sons that are born to David. Now, as we're reading through this, I'm sure we normally get to these and we say, these are people that I don't hear much about in Scripture other than this. We're going to meet Amnon later. We're going to meet Absalom later. We're going to meet Adonijah later. Okay? So Amnon is the one who thinks he's in love with his half-sister Tamar and that whole terrible incident. And so Absalom, who's the full brother of Tamar, eventually takes revenge on him and kills him. And then later revolts against David and leads a rebellion against David the king. And then later, after that's put down, when David is about to die, Joab tries to crown Adonijah as the king in the place of Solomon, but David has already crowned Solomon as king, and so there's a conflict between Adonijah and Solomon. And so these men's names come up later, but there's others here that we don't know a whole lot about. Why does this passage then include this list of sons being born to David? Well, remember, there's a couple questions that the book of Samuel is trying to answer. First of all, what should the king of Israel, how should he govern, is really the question. How should the king of Israel govern? Should he govern like the pagan kings around him for the sake of their own power? Or is God the real king and they govern as God's representative? And that's the right answer. They govern as God's representative. That's why David is a man after God's own heart. He recognizes that. All right, the second question is then, who is this person? Who's the one that would do this? And Saul, we've seen in 1 Samuel, by the end of 1 Samuel, has disgraced himself and disqualified himself from being the kind of king who would rule with God as the true king and himself as God's representative. We've seen David, though, trust God time after time to deliver him, not to prematurely, you know, kill Saul to try to take the throne. David hasn't done any of those kinds of things. And so since that's the question it's trying to answer, if one of the questions is, who's suitable to be the king of Israel? Well, if you're going to have a king, one of the things that's implied in monarchy is a succession, right? So we don't have a monarchy, thank the Lord, in America. We're very happy not to have one. But they still have a monarchy in Great Britain. And they still take it pretty seriously. The monarch doesn't have a whole lot of power anymore. Mostly a figurehead, but they have a queen. And Queen Elizabeth II seems like a pretty decent lady. You know, she doesn't seem like some tyrannical monarch. She seems like a nice grandmother these days, right? Or great grandmother, maybe. And just it goes along nicely. But one of the questions is, what happens when she dies? Who becomes next in line? And they have a list. All right? The next in line is Charles, her son. And then the next in line after him is his son. And then the next in line after him is his son. All right? Who's just a small child. So what happens if they all three die? Who's next? Well, then you go to the daughter, I think. All right? So they have this whole convoluted way to do it. And I remember people asking the question. So Prince Charles isn't very popular in Great Britain, relatively. Elizabeth's pretty popular. Prince Charles isn't all that popular. But Prince William is popular. So will the queen, before she dies, said, Charles isn't going to be the king, William is? No, she's not going to say that. You know why she's not going to say that? I'm not an expert on English politics, but I'm going to tell you why she's not going to say that. That's not how monarchy works. If you start choosing the person who's better suited for it, you just got rid of the monarchy. That's called an election, usually. Right? You have an election to choose the best suited person to fill the job. When you have a monarchy, it's inherited. And if you get rid of the inheritance, then you got rid of the monarchy. Okay, so they had kings. And the way it worked is a king's son was next in line for the throne. The good news is that when you have six sons, there's not a lot of question of whether or not you're a viable monarch, because if you die, there are six people waiting there to be the next king. You see, what this is showing is the suitability of David to be the king. Not only that, it's showing how God has blessed David. Biblically, children are considered a blessing from the Lord. Our society doesn't look at children that way. They do and they don't, okay? But you know, you... And ladies in our church can testify to this. You're in the grocery store with your small children. So, or neighbors have said this. I remember years ago that Hudson had just been born. He was a little one, maybe a year old. And so, you know, AJ was, I think, kindergarten. William was a preschooler. Hudson was a year old. And Heidi, most of you remember Heidi, Julie's sister, came over to visit. And as she was walking up the driveway, our next-door neighbor, Heidi and Julie look somewhat alike. They're sisters. Our next-door neighbor saw Heidi, and Heidi was expecting. And she saw her, and she said, oh, you poor thing, you already have three kids, and you're expecting a fourth? All right? Now, from a biblical perspective, now she was confused on who it was, but from a biblical perspective, if you thought somebody was having a fourth child, wouldn't you congratulate them? Why is it that the world offers pity when you have another child coming? Okay? Now, I recognize, ladies, don't misunderstand me. I am not belittling the amount of work it is to take care of small children. I know that that's a lot of work, and I know that, you know, some of it is she's got, you know, four children under five. That ends up being quite a, you know, a burden for a lady of work, labor and work. But that doesn't take away from the fact that the child is a blessing. If they're not a blessing, stop working so hard to take care of them. Do you follow what I'm saying? Why would you put all that hard work into something that's worthless? You don't do that, do you? So, for example, if you had two cars, all right, you had one in your driveway that was brand new. Say you had a brand new Lexus sitting in your driveway, 2 weeks old. And also sitting in your driveway was a 1974 Pinto that had no wheels on it, a fender missing, and it rained, and you decided, I need to go wash my car. Which one? You only had time to wash one. Which one are you going to wash? Not the Pinto, right? It's not drivable. It looks like junk. It wasn't very drivable even when it was brand new. Right? You remember those vehicles? Some of you teenagers have no idea the kind of car I'm talking about. They weren't nice. They were these difficult cars back then. And, you know, they had bad reputations. They didn't look good. So would you put a lot of time into that? No, because it has no value. But why would you put a lot of time into the Lexus? Why would you wash it and wax it? Because it's worth a lot of money. And you want to keep that clear coat holding up, and you want to make sure that it's clean and looks good and runs well. And, you know, you're going to go get the oil changed and make sure that the tires are rotated, make sure they have enough air in them. Why would you put that effort into it? Because there's an investment there that's worth a lot. So why do we put so much effort into our children? Because they are a blessing from God, and they're of great value before the Lord. What this is showing also is that God had blessed David. Now, we live in this culture that views children as a nuisance, as a problem. The Western world, I mean, this is an issue for us, okay? That we have gotten to the place where we can't be bothered to have children anymore. Now, I'm not preaching that you have to have as big of a family as biologically possible. Don't misunderstand me. But recently they had, what is it? I don't know what it is, G10, G12, whatever summit, one of those economic summits. And the heads of the European nations met. And only two of them had their own biological children. Now, sometimes the Lord doesn't bless you with biological children. That's not what I'm talking about. These are people who had lived into their 50s and had never decided to have children. Not because they were unable. They decided that it was unnecessary to have children. That's problematic. Okay? Your society won't last very long if everybody makes that decision. And we're starting to get on that slope in America as well, where people view children as a nuisance, and I can't live my life the way I want to, and so therefore, we don't see them as a blessing from God. Now, there's some people, and I don't mean to put guilt on anybody here that doesn't need to have guilt put on them. You may have a physical reason you can't have children, or there may be. So nobody in here start looking around and try to figure out who's disobeying this commandment, because you don't know people's personal issues. And not everybody's going to, you know, the first time they meet you, going to say, hello, my husband and I have been trying to have children for years, but we're unable. They're just not going to share that with you. If you're a close friend, they might. But most people are not going to share that with you. And sometimes we can be judgmental about people who don't have children. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm asking, though, is for us to recognize that God tells us children are a blessing. The children God has given you are a blessing. The children that God has given your children, your grandchildren, are a blessing. All right? And yes, they can be hard. They are hard work. Yes, sometimes there are heartbreaks. Sometimes there's difficulties there. But nonetheless, they are a blessing from the Lord. And so we see God blessing David. This is part of David grew stronger and stronger, and Saul's house grew weaker and weaker. And it came to pass there, while there was war between the house of Saul and the house of David, that Abner made himself strong for the house of Saul. Remember, Abner is the chief general of Saul, and he's gotten behind Ishbosheth here. And Abner, he's the real power behind the throne. And Saul had a concubine whose name was Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah. And Ishbosheth said to Abner, wherefore hast thou gone into my father's concubine? So for whatever reason, Abner decides this woman he'd like to have as a wife, basically, as a concubine. This is an unusual word, all right? It's not related to a porcupine, all right? Contrary to sometimes children's church thinking and stuff like that. A concubine was basically a wife who was not of your same social status. All right, we don't have this kind of thinking in our culture today. But in the ancient world, if you were a rich and powerful man, and you wanted to marry a woman who was a slave, you didn't go to her father and ask to marry her. You simply purchased her as a slave and made her your wife. And therefore, she was called your concubine. If, however, we see some of the ladies that are mentioned here as David's wives, so we find that Absalom, the son of Maacah, Absalom is born. He's the son of Maacah, who's the daughter of Talmai, king of Geshur. So why does David marry this woman, Maacah? Because her dad's a king, and this is a political alliance. So he marries this woman, and so therefore that's a wife. She's a princess, so it's his peer. But if there's a slave girl and you think, I'm not condoning this. This is how it happened in the ancient world. You look at it and you say, wow, that's really wonderful young woman. She looks, you know, really attractive. I'd like her for a wife. I've got a half a dozen now, but I want a few more. That's how they worked back then. And what you did is you said, you know, well, how much for her? And you purchased her and she became your wife. Not advocating this, but that's what a concubine was, okay? And so her husband technically is dead, Saul. But Abner takes her as a wife, basically, as a concubine. And Ishbosheth gets angry at this. There's a reason he becomes angry at this, and that is that this is actually a challenge to the throne. Who has the right to take somebody else's wife? You don't. So in other words, you're claiming to have royal authority to go and take this concubine like he's done. You see, so what he's doing, whether it's a move for the throne or whether it's just trying to consolidate his authority in the kingdom, Ishbosheth knows full well the implications of this, but he doesn't know full well that he's not really the king. That the real power is Abner. So he calls Abner on it. He says, why have you done this? Then was Abner very wroth for the words of Ishbosheth and said, am I a dog's head, which against Judah do you show kindness this day unto the house of Saul, thy father, to his brethren and to his friends, and have not delivered thee into the hand of David, that thou chargest me today with a fault concerning this woman? Basically what he's saying, who do you think I am? I'm the one who's kept you on the throne. And if I want to go take a concubine, you better not talk to me about it. Because the only reason David's not king is because of me. And there's even, you can almost read this veiled attack in it, right? And to his friends, and have not delivered thee into the hand of David. He says, oh yeah, I'm the one who hasn't turned you over to David and betrayed you. Well, that seems like a reasonable thing not to do, but what's the implication here? This is a threat. Look, I can do this. I have the power to do this. Don't forget I have the power to do this. Now he takes an oath. So do God to Abner and more also, except as the Lord has sworn to David, even so I do to him. So do God to Abner is a vow, he's saying. I'm vowing before God that I'm going to turn the kingdom over to David. But here's an exceptional statement. He says, except as the Lord has sworn to David. He's recognizing God has promised David the throne. Why have you been trying to keep that from happening all up to this time? In other words, he already knows that David's the rightful king. And he's done what he could to keep it from happening because it gave him more power to do so. Because he was the real power behind Ishbosheth's throne. And so what he decides is that I'm going to go and take my power and give it over to David. Because I'm sure David will pay me well and reward me well if I side with him. And he'll have no throne left. To translate the kingdom from the house of Saul and to set up the throne of David over Israel and over Judah from Dan to Beersheba. All right, so this is a geographical expression. Dan is in the far north up near Mount Hermon. All right, I wish I could show you pictures, but Israel's a very interesting place. You can stand on the shores of the Sea of Galilee. And if you stand on the shores of the Sea of Galilee, you can see across the sea. It's a very large lake. Freshwater lake that the apostles would used to fish on before they were called to follow Jesus. And on the other side of it, you can see the Transjordan, the hills on the other side. Okay, and you can look down a little bit to the southeast, and you can see into the actual nation of Jordan and see the Jordan River running. You can't usually see all the way to the Dead Sea. That's a little too far to see. But you can look to the north, and as you look to the north, you can see out in the distance, way off in the distance, this mountain with a snow cap on it. Snow Peak, it's Mount Hermon. Okay, that's about the far northern historical boundaries of the nation. Israel is one of the few places in the world that you could spend the night at the ski resort on Mount Hermon, go skiing in the morning, catch a plane after lunch, and go snorkeling at Eilat, which is down in the Red Sea, in the afternoon. So you could ski and snorkel at the same time in the same country in one day. People have actually done it. A very unusual setting, all right? So you have this Snow Peak Mountain in the north, and you go to the south. Beersheba is in what's called the Negev, the south. It's an area of low rain, but it's far south below the Dead Sea, a little bit just down toward the bottom of the Dead Sea. And it's the far southern point of the cities of Israel. So from Dan to Beersheba would be like from Atlantic to Pacific, we might say, in the United States, right? Or from Florida to Alaska. You're going to cover most of the United States that way. You might leave Hawaii out, but you're going to cover most of the United States that way. So Dan to Beersheba means, right now David's ruling over Judah, but I'm going to give him everything. And he could not answer Abner a word again because he feared him. Ishbosheth knows he can't, doesn't have anything to say because he has no real power. What army does he have? His army answers to Abner. What authority does he have? His authority all comes from Abner. What connections does he have? His connections all come from Abner. He has nothing. He's on the throne because Abner put him there. In contrast, in contradiction to what God wanted, and that was David to be on the throne, Abner's been blocking this whole time, and he says, finally, I'm going to do what the Lord wants. Well, why? I mean, we can see this man's character was not one to say, I fear God, and we want for Israel what God wants for Israel. He's just saying, I want power. And Abner sent messengers to David on his behalf, saying, whose is the land? Saying also, make thy league with me, and behold, my hand shall be with thee to bring about all Israel unto thee. So he starts sending out messengers to David and David's representatives and allies and saying, look, I'm going to give you the kingdom. And he said, well, I will make a league with thee, but one thing I require of thee, that is, thou shalt not see my face except thou first bring Michal, Saul's daughter, when thou comest to see my face. So what do we see here? David says, fine, I'll make a league with you, Abner, but you have to do something for me. I need Michal, however you want to say her name. Michal is the Hebrew pronunciation. I need Michal. That's his first wife, remember? But Saul divorced David from his daughter and married her off to somebody else. Now, why does David want Michal? Maybe he has fond memories of his first marriage in those early days and how his wife was stolen from him, and he's trying to make that right. I think there's also another aspect to this, and that is that if she's David's wife and David's going to be the king, we've got the same issue we have with Ishbosheth and the concubine. That is, she can't be married to somebody else. She has to stay in David's house in order for him to consolidate authority. He's not just asking for, you know, I love my first wife. There may be some of that involved, but what he's saying is, you can't really bring me the kingdom unless you bring me Michal, because anybody else that is married to her has challenged my throne because they have my wife. That's the way it worked in the ancient world. They're taking prerogatives that belong to the king. Now, I know this makes no sense to us in modern America. We don't operate this way. Marriage is about romance primarily, not about political alignments and these kinds of things, but it was about political alignments in that day. And David sent messengers to Ishbosheth, Saul's son, saying, deliver me my wife Michal, which I espoused to me for 100 foreskins of the Philistines. And Ishbosheth sent and took her from her husband, even from Phaltiel, the son of Laish. And her husband went with her along, weeping behind her to Bahurim. Then said Abner unto him, go, return. And he returned. So David sends a message and says, hey, give me my wife. And they bring her down to David. Now, think about this. There's really been decades that have passed since he married Michal. Or at least a decade. And she's been married to another man for almost 10 years or more. More than that, really. Been married to another man for quite some time. And now she's being forced to go back to her first husband. We have no indication that she wants to do this. Okay? And we certainly know that her husband doesn't want her to go. He's grieving. I mean, imagine any of us, okay, that somebody shows up and says, we're taking your wife and taking her back to this other man. And if you oppose us, we're going to kill you. This is what's going on here, all right? It's a kind of bizarre situation. That, yes, women were treated as property, but this is like the worst example of it. I mean, it's like, you stole my cow, send her back. I don't mean to be rude, but that's kind of how they're dealing with her. I'm not saying women are cows, don't misunderstand me, okay? But what I'm saying is, they're treating her like she's cattle, not like she's human, and like these relationships matter. And so the husband is sent away. And Abner had communication with the elders of Israel, saying, ye fought for David in times past to be king over you. Now then, do it. For the Lord had spoken of David, saying, by the hand of my servant David, I will save my people Israel out of the hand of the Philistines and out of the hand of all their enemies. And Abner also spake in the ears of Benjamin. And Abner also went to speak in the ears of David in Hebron that seemed good to Israel and that seemed good to the whole house of Benjamin. So Abner came to David to Hebron and 20 men with him. And David made Abner and the men that were with him a feast. So he's going to be a good host and he throws a feast for them. And Abner said unto David, I will arise and go and will gather all Israel unto my lord the king, that they may make a league with thee, and that thou mayest reign over all the heart, that thy heart desireth. And David sent Abner away, and he went in peace. And behold, the servants of David and Joab came from pursuing a troop and brought in a great spoil with them. But Abner was not with David in Hebron, for he had sent him away, and he was gone in peace. When Joab and all the host that was with him were come to they told Joab, saying, Abner the son of Ner came to the king, and he has sent him away, and he's gone in peace. Then Joab came to the king and said, what hast thou done? Behold, Abner came unto thee. Why is it that thou hast sent him away? And is he quite gone? In other words, he was here and you didn't kill him? He's the real power before the throne of Ishbosheth. What's going on? Thou knowest Abner, the son of Ner, that he came to deceive thee and to know thy going out and thy coming in and all that thou doest. He only came here to spy the place out. And when Joab was come out from David, he sent messengers after Abner, which brought him again from the well of Sirah, but David knew it not. And when Abner was returned to Hebron, Joab took him aside in the gate to speak with him quietly and smote him there under the fifth rib, that he died for the blood of Asahel, his brother. So Joab's still mad about his brother being killed, right? Joab's still upset about this, and he's your typical, I solve everything with violence kind of guy. And he decides, okay, this guy's politically inexpedient one. Abner was the chief general, the chief of the military under Saul. And he's offering the kingdom to David. You know, this seems like this is how I won't keep my job as David's chief military leader unless I get rid of this guy. And not only that, he killed my brother, so I want to get rid of him. So he does this. The funny thing is he says, Abner came here to trick you, but Joab's the one who plays the trick here. The mortal trick. And afterward, when David heard it, he said, I and my kingdom are guiltless before the Lord forever from the blood of Abner, the son of Ner. Let it rest on the head of Joab and all his father's house, and let there not fail from the house of Joab one that hath an issue, or that is a leper, or that leaneth on a staff, or that falleth on the sword, or that lacketh bread. He actually curses Joab's house here. Joab's been real faithful to him, but here David's saying, I want you to know clearly I had nothing to do with this. I did not command this. This is not how the king of Israel is supposed to govern, with bloodthirst for power. So Joab and Abishai, his son, his brother, slew Abner because he had slain their brother Asahel at Gibeon in battle. And David said to Joab and to all the people that were with him, rend your clothes and gird with sackcloth and mourn before Abner. And the king David himself followed the bier. And they buried Abner in Hebron. And the king lifted up his voice and wept at the grave of Abner. And all the people wept. And the king lamented over Abner and said, died Abner as a fool dieth. Thy hands were not bound, nor thy feet put into fetters. As a man falleth before wicked men, so fellest thou. And all the people wept again over him. And when all the people came to cause David to eat meat while it was yet day, David sware, saying, so do God to me, and more also, if I taste bread or aught else till the sun be down. And all the people took notice of it, and it pleased them, as whatsoever the king did pleased all the people. For all the people and all Israel understood that day that it was not of the king to slay Abner the son of Ner. And the king said unto his servants, know ye not that there is a prince and a great man fallen this day in Israel? And I am this day weak, though anointed king. And these men, the son of Zeruiah, be too hard for me. The Lord shall reward the doer of evil according to his wickedness. Now, consistent with David's pattern here, he decides not to do something to Joab right away. Later, he's going to give Solomon instructions on how to deal with Joab. But he doesn't do anything right away. Just like he said, you know, I'll let God deal with Saul, I'm going to let God deal with Joab. He had the power to pronounce this curse, all right, because of his position as king of Israel. And so basically what he does is he behaves in such a remarkable way. Just like he grieves Saul and Jonathan, he grieves Abner. And all the people can tell this is genuine. He wouldn't have called for this man's death and done this and grieved like this. It wasn't a flippant, oh, it's so bad that Abner's dead. No, he grieved and he led the people in grieving. Notice here, how would the king of Israel rule? He's not going to rule as a bloodthirsty tyrant who's hungry for power. He's going to be one that is going to deal with people honestly and justly, not like Joab deals with Abner here. All right? Now, this is actually, if we think about it, a very shocking chapter of the Bible. We have a situation with a concubine. We have a crazy, messed up marriage divorce situation. We have power plays. And then we have a murder of a man through deception. But this was the ancient world. Now, one thing we have to understand about this. When we approach Old Testament narratives, we have to understand that they are describing what happened and that their message of their book is giving us God's message. But not everything that happens in an Old Testament narrative are we supposed to emulate. Okay? Even when it's done by good people. Even when it's done by good people. So David's asking for Michal to come back to him, and treating her like property is not something necessarily that's supposed to be emulated. Joab's treating of Abner this way. Now, this was very expedient. Joab became very powerful for a lot of years because of this. I mean, Joab's life was better because he did this. He felt better about killing his brother, the person who killed his brother, and he you know, stayed in a position of power because of it. But the problem is that he murdered this man. Joab doesn't seem to have any concern for the Lord. You don't really find the Lord entering into Joab's thinking. Joab thinks very much like a worldly man who, yes, he serves David, but he doesn't seem to share David's faith. He's a very good servant of David, but he doesn't seem to share David's faith. And so we do have to note this, that there is a considerable amount of violence in 1 and 2 Samuel. But yet the New Testament holds forth a position to us of trusting God to settle things with justice and not to try to get things by violence. And in fact, the Old Testament would say the same thing, that, you know, those who live in violent ways, whether it's Proverbs or other passages, that's condemned by the Lord. Okay? But yet this was life back then. And this was, and I don't mean to be gory and things in it, but this was very, you had to get up close and personal to kill people back then. You looked them in the face when you killed them. And their blood got on you when you killed them. It was not, you couldn't, you know, drop a missile from a drone from 10,000 feet and evaporate their house. Even though that person's equally dead either way, it's a whole lot easier to push a button than to look somebody in the face and have them bleed out on you. I'm not trying to be gory, but that's what this world was like. They were used to this kind of bloodletting going on. Now, the numbers are relatively small compared to modern wars. You know, we saw this war between David and Ishbosheth, and the numbers of casualties are in the hundreds, not in the tens of thousands or millions like you might have during some of the world wars. But nonetheless, you have this kind of violence going on everywhere. This isn't necessarily commending this. In fact, when David wants to build the temple, what does the Lord say? No, you can't be the one to build the temple for me because you've been a man of war. Not that he sinned because he was a man of war, but there's still something outside of God's plan. Okay? Let's keep this in mind. It's not a sin to engage in a just war, but it's still outside of God's plan for war to exist. When Jesus returns and this creation is restored and the curse is reversed, is there ever going to be a war again? No. It's better to not kill people. We need to agree on that. The biblical truth. It's better to not kill people. Now, there may be times that in a fallen world, we are put in a place where the only way that we don't get killed is to defend ourselves. Or where our government calls on us to wage war on their behalf. That may happen. Okay? And the Bible allows for both of those things, but it's an allowance. It's not the ideal. Right? It's better to have a time of peace than a time of war. And it's you know, I greatly appreciate those who've served our country in the armed forces, especially those who've sacrificed everything by dying, and especially those who have seen combat. And I don't mean to belittle the service of those who were in support roles, because that was equally necessary. You can't wage war without support. But, you know, it is a difficult thing, and it changes a person. I've not experienced it, but I have experienced watching people leave and come back and seeing the impact that war has had on them, and it has an impact on their person. All right? It just does. Because God didn't make us to kill each other. And that wasn't his original plan. So yes, there's war in these passages, but war should be something that we greatly avoid and try to, that we greatly regret and try to avoid. In other words, we should be something, you know, it's not like, and I realize sometimes we just want to think this way. I was years ago, like 3 weeks after, 2 weeks, 3 weeks after September 11th, we did an outreach down in New York, and we were going around, we were handing out tracts, inviting people to an outreach and offering counseling to people. And I was down near Wall Street in New York City. And I went to hand this man, he was well-dressed, business suit, briefcase, I went to hand him one of the tracts. And it had a picture of the World Trade Center on it, not burning, but intact. And he looked at me and he said, unless it says nuke them all, I don't want to read it. Well, people were still pretty mad. Many of our young people were born after September 11th, so you don't remember the incident. But those of us who were living through it, we were pretty angry, saddened and very angry. We wanted this straightened out so this never happened again. Right, so there can be that kind of fervor for it. But on the other hand, the cost of it is very high to go to war. And I don't mean, again, I'm not preaching against those who fought. I greatly appreciate their service. But let's recognize the point that they paid a price to serve. Not only did they give up years of their life or months of their life to serve, but it changed them. I've often told the stories about my grandfathers, but one of them served in the South Pacific. And the stories he told me, I would have thought he was in the Army for 3 years or something. But I actually saw his service record that my grandmother has. He served 6 months in the South Pacific and was sent home. And he changed his life forever. 50 confirmed kills in 6 months. That's a lot of... he served in the AmeriCal, I think it's the 23rd Infantry AmeriCal Division. When the Marines took Guadalcanal, they got decimated pretty bad, and they needed some backup, and the closest backup was the AmeriCal Army Division. It was the only Army Division to be at Guadalcanal. That was his unit. He was sent in, so he was at the Solomon Islands and Guadalcanal, and that's where he saw combat. Horrific combat. And the rest of his life, he self-medicated with alcohol. And as a kid, I just knew Grandpa drank a lot. But looking back at it now as an adult, I realized there was probably what they would label as PTSD these days, and that it was easier to be drunk and pass out and go to bed than it was to have the nightmares at night. And that's what he did. So 6 months of his life at 18 or 19 years old, whatever his age was very costly. It impacted the whole rest of his life. Not saying that those prices don't have to be paid for freedom sometimes, but let's recognize it's a high one at a high personal cost of the people that go, sometimes their life. What I'm saying here is we ought to be careful about not romanticizing it. One of his experiences, he had a high school friend he was in the same unit with. His high school friend was 5'11", and they were putting all the 6-foot guys in one company and anybody under 6 foot in another one. And he stood on his tiptoes to be able to stand next to my grandfather. And they didn't notice, and he got into that company. Well, my grandfather watched him take a bullet through the head in combat. They were high school friends. How do you bring that home with you? How do you go by and visit those family friends? Because they're going to want to know, how did our boy die? And that's the last thing you want to think about. And you're never going to tell them that story. Well, I saw him get shot in the head. You're never going to tell a mother that, right? You got to live with that at 18 or 19 years old. It's terrible. It's horrific. Okay, so war is a bad, bad thing that God never intended for us to have. So we ought to be cautious here. Yes, it's something that sometimes has to be done, right? It would be the same as this. If somebody breaks into my house and is going to harm my family and I have to use mortal force to defend my family, I think it's right and biblical to do that. But God didn't make the creation so that would have to happen normally. And I hope I never have to do that. The last thing I ever want to do is kill somebody else. It's a sobering thing to think that I might have to do that. I would hope that I could scare them off, tell them I've called the police, point a gun at them or something and tell them, get out of here. And that they would leave because they'd be frightened off. That's what I would hope would happen. But if you have to defend yourself, you have to defend yourself. But that's not how God... See, that's due to the fall. That's due to the fall. And so we need to be very careful that we not romanticize these things. Yes, honor those who served, but not romanticize it so that every young man thinks he wants to go shoot more people. There's a place. There's a place for serving our country that way, but it's bad when it has to go there. Second, this passage, and again, we're dealing with a passage that has very much of the ancient Near East built into it in regard to women and women's roles in the world and those kinds of things. All right, and in this passage, women are definitely property. Even David here marries women that he marries because they're important. Okay, Ahinoam was politically connected in Israel. It's probably why he married her. Maaka, Talmai's daughter, politically connected to another king. So he's making alliances with kings who can help him with trade or with military help and these kinds of things. And Michal, you know, somebody else being married to her is a threat to his throne. There's all kinds of problems here with this. This is not advocating for us that this is how we ought to treat women. The New Testament seems to give us a rethinking of this. That when you know, we see the role of women in the New Testament church, and we can think of Lydia, right, in Philippi. Or, you know, these women that are commended to us in the New Testament. That when we see them held up for us, we can see that God views women as being made in his image. And as what does Peter say? That we're to treat our wives like joint heirs. Heirs together of the grace of life. All right? So the Bible does not hold forth a kind of patriarchy that this passage has. Okay? That says that men are inherently superior to women. And that women are to be treated as property to be traded and bought and sold and these kinds of things. I mean, there's lots of cultures around the world where, you know, your wealth is measured by how many wives you have. I had a friend that was traveling in a Muslim area with his wife, and she had blonde hair. And in that culture, blonde is very sought after because there aren't very many women with blonde hair. And a man who was very wealthy said, I'd like to buy your wife. He said, no, I don't think so. He said, I'll give you 3 camels. He had no way to get him on the plane, so he didn't make the deal. I'm kidding. I'm joking. No, he loved his wife. He was never going to sell his wife, obviously. But the point was that it was a different culture, right? Women are bought and sold. And if you see a beautiful woman that belongs to somebody else and you want to buy her, he can divorce her and you can buy her and marry her and you can work on things that way. And you know. And I'm not making fun of a particular culture. That's a true story. A friend of mine, he was an evangelist, and he was over in the Middle East, and that actually happened to him. So I'm not making fun of that culture. I'm just saying that's rooted. You go back in time, and part of this is due to the fact that women, when you don't have peace and when you have war and when life is in jeopardy, women tend to bear the brunt of it more than men. Yes, men tend to be the soldiers, but let's face it, even in our culture today, when you go out after dark, men, you know, if you hear the strange noise, what was that? Like somebody's at the door. Do you send your wife? I don't know. You go check it out. No. You go, right? Because hopefully, with a little bit extra physical strength that men generally have, you could cope with whatever threat at the front door better. And in the ancient world, what was recognized, and especially with, like I said, with the way their warfare worked and everything else, a man could defend his family easier. And so what happens is women look for defenders. And they look for a man who can defend them. And when that happens, then men are in the driving seat and they get to demand things of women and treat women in ways that are unfair and unjust. And if you don't think it happens in our society, I mentioned it this morning, but it's the same thing now. Weinstein's been in the news for a week now, right? He was doing the same thing. He was just doing it as a Hollywood mogul with money and power to put people into films. But it's the same thing. He's not treating women any differently. He's not enlightened. The way he views it is, I can give you a part in a role, and if you do me certain favors, then you might get the job. Which is completely immoral, obviously. Not just from the morality side of these aren't his wives, but you just don't treat people that way. You don't use your power to abuse people, no matter what position you're in. Whether it's women or men or children, you don't use power to abuse them. Okay, now, I'm not preaching against primarily the ancient Near Eastern culture. What I'm saying is we make a mistake if we come to the scriptures and say, they did it, so we should do it. If we come to it and say, well, you know, what we really should do is get back into buying and selling women, then I think we're not understanding the text of Scripture well. There's a lot of things that happen in these texts that are sinful, that don't rightly recognize the image of God in people, that don't recognize the value of human life and the sanctity of human life. There are a lot of things that go like this in these texts, but what we find, nonetheless, is the trajectory of the passage, that we find these examples of people trusting God, even in the midst of a fallen world. And we, as hard as we want to be on them, we have to remember that we have blind spots about our own culture. That we might look at them and go, you bought and sold women? That's ridiculous. That sounds like ISIS or something, right? But they would look at our culture and they'd say, you do what? You murder your unborn children? You reward men for dressing up like women? And you punish people? Was it I heard that there was a law passed in one of our states recently that if you use the wrong pronoun intentionally about somebody, you can spend a year in jail? So if there's a man who dresses like a woman and wants you to call him she, and you call him he, and you do it intentionally, you can spend a year in jail. That's the way the law passed. I think it'll be challenged before the courts and probably not hold up. I don't know. I'm not an expert on those things. But that's kind of crazy. In other words, here's a man dressed as a woman, and you say, what's he doing? And he hears you, and he's offended. You can be punished because you're being transphobic or whatever. So what you have to do is find out what pronoun they want to be called by and make sure you call them by whatever it is. Folks, this is madness. It really is. It is. And I'm not trying to get political here. This is a biblical truth. Men and women were both created in the image of God. But they were created in the beginning. God created them what? Male and female. Not with 59 different genders. Male and female. And men are men and women are women. That's the biblical truth. And that doesn't mean that we have to be harsh to people or mean to people or cruel to people. All right? I'm not talking about going and beating people up or calling them names or anything like that. Let's have compassion on people because those people are very confused. But we can't go out and act like reality isn't reality and God's creation isn't God's creation and that God doesn't care about these things. He does. And so they would look at our society and look at it and say, that's crazy. Why would you do that? But yet, if we told some of the stories about people worshiping God and honoring God in our society, would they still honor God? Sure. And here we have inspired Scripture telling us the stories of people like David and others who, yes, all along the way they're sinners, and they're also part of their culture. It's what they know. But yet we see them trusting God even in the midst of a fallen culture. Even when they have their missteps and their mistakes and their sins, they're trusting God in the midst of a fallen culture, and we see God watching over them and blessing them. David is a great example here. He had the power to do what his culture said. Kill the other king who's fallen into your hands and take the throne. It's rightfully yours. God has anointed you king. And he didn't do that to Saul. He had the opportunity to do things and try to hurry up God's timetable, and he didn't do that. He trusted the Lord in the midst of it. And so that still does give us a paradigm for us to say, we can trust the Lord in the midst of a culture that's very different than us. That when people are saying, hey, it would be acceptable, this is what our culture allows, we can say, but that's not what God wants me to do. That we can say, this wouldn't be glorifying to God. That I can be unlike my culture in ways. But we also recognize that there are going to be times that we have blind spots. I'm not excusing them, I'm just saying we will. John Newton wrote the hymn Amazing Grace. Many of you know his story. John Newton worked on a slave ship. All right? He worked on a slave ship. One point, if I remember the story right, he was washed overboard and he was drowning. And he called to somebody on the ship to help him. The man grabbed a harpoon and harpooned him through the leg and reeled him up onto the ship. I mean, these were brutal men. They were in a slave trade. But after he became a Christian and was converted, he quit the slave trade. But you know how many years he was still in the slave trade? It was years, he continued, as the captain of a slave ship before he quit it and realized it was contrary to the gospel. Because everybody in the culture accepted that kind of slavery. That you fill a ship as full of people as you can, that you bought from the slave markets of Africa, and if they starve to death, if they die of disease, if they're old and infirm and they die on the voyage, too bad, throw their bodies in the ocean. And just keep making your passage because there's money to be made at the other end. These were people made in the image of God and they were treated that way. And here's a Christian man, the captain of that ship, and he did it for years until he came to the conclusion that this is wrong. He could hear the groans of people overpacked into the holds of those ships. And he knew how wicked it was. And he repented and turned from it. But you see, he was a creature of his culture. We often are too, and David was too. But yet, God still used John Newton in wonderful ways. We see growth in his life. We see God's help in his life. He didn't write Amazing Grace while he was captaining a slave ship. He wrote that after he had repented of that and gone into the ministry. But nonetheless, there were some terrible things that went on, just like we have today, just like they have in the ancient world. It doesn't mean we emulate all those things. In other words, if I view John Newton as a role model, then what I recognize is that doesn't mean if I want to be like John Newton that I go become the captain of a slave ship. I remember a friend of mine saying that he would counsel with people and they'd say, well, you know, such and such a godly person did this or that. And his answer to them was, so you're going to be a combination of all the worst qualities of the best people you know. You know, well, Spurgeon used to smoke tobacco, and so it'd be okay for me too. Well, smoking's really bad for your health, and I think our culture's come to that conclusion these days. But to do it because, hey, Spurgeon used to do it, if I really want to be a good, better preacher, I'm going to go start smoking. No. All right. In other words, I could choose the flaws of every famous preacher and include all of them in my life. Would that make me a better person? I'll be a slave trader like John Newton and, have the flaws of Spurgeon and of, you know, William Carey wasn't the best of husbands. And you could go through a whole bunch of things. John Wesley especially wasn't a very good husband. We're separated from his wife for years. You know, you could say, well, I'm going to be like these people. Well, there's plenty of ways to be like those people, but not in every note because some of them are sinful. And in the same way, when we come to an Old Testament narrative, I'm not trying to belabor this, but people do this. They love to take Old Testament narratives and pull a piece out and say, David did it, so I can do it. Well, no, no, no. All right, let's not treat the scriptures that way. What you have to do is look at the context of what's going on here. Here's God establishing David, even in the midst of David living in his culture, being a sinner, God is establishing David. But yet there are things that David does that are countercultural, and we need to be countercultural in our faith in God. That if we're going to trust God, we're not going to be like this world. There are going to be times that we're not like this world. And so the Lord calls on us to be people who trust him, even in the midst of a sinful culture. Let's bow our heads. Our Heavenly